Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I had to work really, really hard to buy that first one. And that one was the one that, you know, leapfrogged me into, you know, the rest of the ones that I've purchased from there on in.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with Claire Monkley, owner of Love Finance, who assists owner-occupiers and investors to purchase property. Hear about her childhood stories growing up on a farm with 10 other siblings, how she leapfrogged her way from one property to another, her simple long-term strategy, and much, much more. Monkley has a company called Love Finance, through which she assists owner-occupiers and investors to purchase property, whether it be buying their first property or finding out what their goals are along their property journey.
I sort of usually help my clients purchase their first property, and then we set up strategies to help them get through to their, you know, their next step for their investment properties or whatever their goals might be along their journey. Sometimes even right into their retirement, because, you know, I like to sort of plan with them maybe 1 year, 5 years, you know, 10 years and help them set those goals so that they can get to where they want to be.
As part of her job on any given day, Monkley does a lot of research around aspects integral to buying a property and meets with clients.
I do a lot of research. So I do a lot of research, obviously, around what rates are, what's happening with interest rates, what's happening with bank policy. I also, every day, I do some education around investment properties, because that is something else, as I said, that I do with my clients. And I like to just be always learning so that I'm, you know, I'm at the best that I can be, that I can share with my clients. So that's pretty much what my day is. And then I'm, you know, meeting with my clients, working out their strategies, and then putting those strategies together and then getting them into a parcel to go off to the lender.
Education for Monkley is very important, as only through education can she properly advise her clients on how to invest in property and help them secure a better retirement.
People are just so busy nowadays, as you are aware, and so they're very, very time poor. And I think it's part of my role is to make sure that I can help them, you know, just learn what other sort of strategies are out there for them to help them to have a better retirement. I mean, at the moment, you know, the statistics are quite high on the amount of people that are retiring on $21,000 a year. And that's a little bit scary for me and for a lot of other people. So I really do believe that education is the key to anything that we do around investing. And I actually assist my clients with that education, and they can then make an informed decision about where they want to purchase a property. It's not necessarily the best property to buy next door because you like the house, because, you know, it could be where you live, could be at the top of the market, you know, when it's peaked out. And so it might be a little while before you get some capital growth. So, you know, it's sort of giving them a little bit more of an open channel that can open their eyes to what else is possible in other areas in Australia.
Growing up in a little town, Monkley was one of 11 children in the family and lived on a farm where they grew their own vegetables and farmed their own cattle.
I actually grew up in a little town called Morpeth, and that's the oldest inland port in New South Wales, believe it or not, and it's quite a little touristy town now. And I'm one of 11 children, so mum and dad, yes, we lived on a farm, and mum and dad obviously never had a TV, as the joke goes, But yeah, 8 brothers and I have 2 sisters. Most of us are probably self-employed. Dad was self-employed. Well, I don't remember him ever not being self-employed, to be honest. And I watched them work very, very hard, you know, their whole life, as you do, as you could imagine, trying to feed and educate 11 children. We had quite a good life on the farm. We used to grow our own vegetables, have our own beef, you know, so we sort of were pretty self-sustainable there.
Because the parents had to manage such a large family, they had a lot of systems in place to ensure everyday tasks got done.
Went on to go to school in Maitland. So went to the Catholic schools there in Maitland, and that's pretty much, you know, where I grew up. That's where I learnt, I suppose, from my dad and my mum about, you know, making sure that you do have, you know, obviously growing up in a family of 11 children, you had to have systems in place to be doing things, whether it was getting dressed on time, making sure the breakfast is ready, you know, the big pot of porridge is ready of a morning for everyone to come out when they've, you know, one bathroom, brush their teeth, you know, wash their face, whatever had to be done. And so we did have a plan, you know, mum was quite regimented how we had our sandwiches and all that done. So I think I learned, you know, obviously a lot of those skills from mum and dad. My father, although there was a lot of money around for us, one thing I was very aware of is that my father bought 2 other properties, and that's where I know that helped them whenever they decided to sell that property at any one time. It was for a particular reason, and that helped mum and dad to probably have a little bit more quality of life in their retirement than perhaps they would have had they have not done that. So that's when that I began thinking about, gee, what would it be like to have a number of properties that actually brought me in income? Mum and dad had, theirs was land and they had beef cattle on it. So it did bring them in income, but just in a different way.
She then goes on to give a little background knowledge about the age gap between herself and her other 10 siblings.
I hope my mother never hears this, but my 2 eldest brothers are actually the same age for 20 days. So that's how close they were. So get that. So my second eldest brother was born on the 3rd of August and my eldest brother was born on the 23rd of August the previous year. So that's a little bit of a joke because they are the same age for those 20 days. And then there's pretty much only about a year between us. And then the last child, so the 10th child, the 11th child, there's 5 years. He wasn't. That was a bit of an accident. But, yeah, we're all pretty close. We're very, very close.
Living on a farm was not easy and was often without many of the modern conveniences we take for granted today. Furthermore, money was not plentiful, especially since her parents went through the 1955 flood in the Maitland area.
We did live on a farm. We had, like, we didn't have running water. We didn't have an inside toilet, you know, like a lot of people did back then. So, you know, our toilet was way up the back in the, like, the back shed, you know, and it was digging the holes to empty the pan toilet and cutting the clothes downstairs to the copper. I can only just vaguely remember that. But my mum and dad, I wasn't alive at the time, but my mum and dad lost absolutely everything in the 55 flood. Maitland area was very renowned for floods, but the 55 flood was the biggest flood that they've ever had, and a lot of people did lose everything. It was quite horrendous. And my dad had just bought his first truck, and he went in to get out. There's a couple of women that were pregnant in what we call Phoenix Park, which is the little area we lived in at Morpeth, and the water came up so fast that Dad actually, the truck got covered in water. They had to get picked up in a boat, so Dad lost his truck, which was pretty sad. So it was challenging times, Mum said. You know, a lot of times people couldn't pay them in money, so they would get paid in, you know, pumpkins or potatoes or bread, you know, different ways of, well, the old days of bartering, wasn't it?
Monkley recounts some childhood memories for us growing up on the farm, and even through times were hard at some points.
Mum and Dad didn't have a car, so we didn't go anywhere. You know, I can remember my Nana coming and picking us up a couple of times. to go different places. We walked to school. We walked a fair way to school. And when we were quite young, that, you know, when you're five, walking to school, that was pretty huge. I can remember my mother trying to teach me to ride a push bike. And we had a magpie that used to live in the tree in the Lucerne paddock across from our house. And Mum used to take us up onto this little hill and let us go. So we had to either, you know, pedal or fall off. And this magpie used to chase us. Oh, man, pick at our heads. So remember that. It was just funny times and hard times, you know. But, yeah, it was good. We had lots of fun, you know. But there was tough times. Definitely there was tough times. But there were some fun times as well.
On the farm, Monkley milked the cows and made her own ice cream, which is a far cry from today's modernised life where everything we get is from the supermarket.
Like to go and milk the cow to get your own milk and to make your own butter, and we used to make our own ice cream. You know, so we did all of that. Our Saturday morning was devoted to, when we were older, was devoted to cooking all those things, all the cakes for our school lunches. We did that every Saturday morning. That was the girls' role and Mum's role. And I'm not talking... I'm talking slab cakes, you know, homemade sponges and chocolate cakes and apple pies and grandma pies. And Mum used to make her own pickles, preserve her own vegetables. You know, that's what it was like, as well as, you know, Mum rearing us. So, I did not even know my mother could knit until I was about 35. And I went to her home one day and she was knitting. I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm knitting your father a scarf." And I went, "I didn't know you could knit." And she went, "Well, when have I ever had time to knit?" I thought, "Yeah, fair enough, Mum. That's fair enough." But I did not know she could knit. I didn't know she could play the piano. She learned the piano when she went to school. Didn't know that. So she could play the piano, yeah.
In Monkley's family, as the older kids grew up, they started to look after their younger siblings, and she recounts these happy moments.
As more came along, obviously we did sort of take up that role because we had to, you know. I can remember pushing my little brother, you know, one of my little brothers along in the pram, just taking them for a long walk. And we could, like, we were on a farm road. So, you know, we would just go and be gone for a couple of hours. You know, Mum knew she didn't have to worry about us because, to be perfectly honest, nobody ever came down the road where we were. So we could just put whoever in the stroller and all the pram and off we go, and Mum knew we'd be perfectly fine, you know. Dad was pretty strict, so we never got up to too much mischief, I can tell you. Well, sorry, that I know about. I'm hearing stories now of even my younger brothers, some of the stuff that they got up to. My God, my blood runs cold. I mean, if Dad ever found out you did that, he would have murdered you.
One of Monkley's fondest memories was when she would go to one of her cousin's farms.
One thing we used to do is where we lived, as I said, it was Morpeth, but Phoenix Park was a little farming area. And so Dad and Mum had a farm there, and we had cousins that had farms, you know, up and around. And one of our cousins used to have turnips, so grow turnip patches, you know. And we used to go over there, and I don't know if you like raw turnips, sorry, but that was one of the things we did like. And we used to go over and sit in the turnip patch. And anybody that likes turnips and eats too many of them knows how badly you get a pain in your stomach from doing that. But they were so sweet and delicious straight off the farm that that's what we'd do, just sit there and eat these turnips. I can remember that as plain as anything.
Providing a perspective on how the lives of different generations change and evolve over time, Monkley recounts something her mother told her the other day.
My mum was telling me the other day, and we forget we have people in our world that do this, but Mum was talking about how because Mum's the youngest of seven children, and Mum's eldest brother used to take them to the dances in the Horse and Sulky. And to hear Mum talk about going to the dances and, you know, taking people around in the Horse and Sulky, and I'm like, "Oh, Mum, I've forgotten that that's the generation that you grew up in." And it's just fascinating to talk to people that, I don't know, they've got a whole different outlook on life as a younger person, you know, when they were a younger person to what we do. And as you were saying about your children and even my children and my grandchildren, what their outlook is on life and what it will be when they get older. Do you know what I mean? It's just... just to think that there was somebody around who was shoeing horses that I know that is my mother, and that's what she'd help do, is just fascinating, because I never saw that as a child, obviously, and perhaps you haven't either, but that was her world.
Monkley went on to high school and during year 10 was offered two jobs, which then led to various other jobs.
So I left school and went to go into hairdressing. So I did that for a number of years, and then I ended up moving to Queensland. One of my brothers moved there. So I did different types of things up there, bar work, restaurant work, you know, just for a bit of a change. Then I came back, got married, and then, you know, obviously had children, and just didn't work for a while. Well, sorry, let me rephrase that. My husband and I had our own business, so I worked from home and helped him run that business. And then, you know, unfortunately, when we separated, I obviously didn't have a job anymore. So then I went and worked for a mortgage broker. And that's how I have come into the field that I am in now and have been myself personally in my business for the last 22 years.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve into Claire Monkley's journey and how she started in property.
So then I found myself out of work, and I was fortunate enough to go and work for this mortgage broker, and I was watching him actually assist his clients to build their wealth through property.
Her worst investing moment.
The gentleman I invested the money with declared himself bankrupt, so left me in quite a, so I'm talking this would be 10 years ago, nearly 11 years ago.
Some of the valuable lessons she had picked up along the way.
I'm more educated and I know, you know, there's more strategic planning that you can put around with where you purchase now.
And that's next. I'm Tyrone Shum and you're listening to Property Investory. After working for a mortgage broker, she began to do the structuring for clients to assist them in building their wealth, and realized she loved doing it, which led to borrowing money to help herself as well.
When my husband and I separated, I, you know, as I said, I worked for his company or our company. So then I found myself out of work, and I was fortunate enough to go and work for this mortgage broker. And I was watching him actually assist his clients to build their wealth through property. And I actually was the one eventually that was doing the structuring for them, and I loved it. I just absolutely loved what it could actually, you know, what borrowing money could do to help you leapfrog yourself into a better position. Now, for me, being a single mother, two young children, my income didn't support enough for me to be paying my small mortgage. I had to get a mortgage on a house. And so I knew, being in the mortgage broking world, that I had to work for 2 years in a casual job before a bank would even take 50% of that income into consideration for servicing. And I know you understand that, servicing the debt and making sure I can repay back the loan that I have. So I actually went and got a second job working in the vineyards. And I can remember for 2 years, I took 2 days off a month. I worked 5 days a week in mortgage broking, and I worked Saturdays and Sundays, all days in the winery. And until I could get that income recognised that a bank would take it for servicing for me to buy my first investment property. Now, I looked around. I couldn't afford much, but I found this house on the market. So it's in Thornton, again, in the Hunter Valley, and it was it's between Newcastle and Maitland. So let's say, you know, it's right in the middle, let's say. And it was $119,000. And I took my boss to have a look at it, and he's like, oh, God, Claire, you know, and I said, but it's the worst house in the best street.
To this day, Monkley still has that property, and she has also done a couple more projects, such as buying a block of land, subdividing into two, and building two properties on it.
I've been told that's what you buy, that's what I've read about. So I bought that house, and I still have that house today. And it's gone up in value. I've done not a thing to it. It's never not been rented. And I think that's probably worth about $410,000 today. And then from that property, then I bought my first one in Newcastle. And I, even though I lived in Maitland, didn't come to Newcastle very much, but bought my second one, bought an apartment here. And I think that I paid $123,000 for that. And now that was valued just recently at $520,000. So they're just a couple. I mean, I've got more. I've done the, buy a block of land, subdivide it off, build two. I've done buy the corner block, put the granny flat on. So I've got one of those. So I've done sort of different types of things. Renovation is not my thing. But I know lots of, I've got friends that do that and make quite good money on it when it's a good market. So that's how I got into that, my first property. I had to work really, really hard to buy that first one. And that one was the one that, leapfrogged me into, the rest of the ones that I've purchased from there on in.
This first property Monkley purchased 16 years ago, and since then, out of all her properties, she has only sold one, which showcases her long-term strategy. She then goes on to tell us a bit more about the property which she eventually sold.
Property is always a long-term strategy, I believe, and that's what has worked for me. I mean, I know other people buy them and flip, but I'm not handy like that, as I said. So my strategy is long-term hold, and I just take the equity out of one, and then I go on and buy another one, and that sort of has allowed me to hold the portfolio that I have. What I must actually, point out to listeners also is that I ended up selling my little house. So I bought a little house when I got divorced, and it was, I'm pretty sure I paid $135,000 for that house. And yes, it was on for $155,000. And I said to the real estate agent, I've only got $135,000 that I know I can, purchase a home for. And I can remember his name was David. And I can remember he said to me, Claire, they will never accept that offer. They won't. He said, it's in Lawn. Anybody that knows the Hunter Valley and knows Maitland and knows Lawn, it's a very prestigious area. And I said, well, that's all I've got. It's an offer. You've got to take it to them. Well, they accepted it. So that was, that was my buy into that. So I really picked up 20,000 equity in there straight away. But I did eventually sell that house because I moved to Newcastle. So I haven't sold investment property other than just that one, but that owner-occupied home I sold because I was limited by my borrowing capacity because of that. So I started to rent, and then I went on and purchased properties. So that was my strategy. I've only just 2 years ago purchased my next owner-occupied. I've rented for, 10 years. And then I've just bought an apartment right in Newcastle.
You're the typical rentvestor then. That's what I love about it.
Oh, rentvestor. Of course, that's a new word. That wasn't around when I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And it does limit us having that owner-occupied property sometimes. And, even every now and then now I think, I could be doing so much more. But how much more do you need to be doing, really? I suppose I'm not as young as I used to be. I can just sit back with what I've got now and just, there's probably another property cycle in there, one, maybe two for me in some of those areas. Because I think the good thing too is when you don't buy in the same area, and I'm sure you're aware of this, different areas go up at different times. So therefore, if one area's, peaked, you might have one in another area that hasn't, and so that one will peak, and the other one that slowed down, you might see another peak come up. So and that is what I've absolutely witnessed without a shadow of a doubt.
Monkley talks about what her property portfolio consists of.
Somebody asked me this yesterday. So I've had nine, ten, and I've sold two. So one being my owner-occupied and one being one here on the harbour in Newcastle. but I chose to sell that one so that I could have some extra funds to buy the new one that I wanted to live in because it was bigger.
For Monkley, one of her worst investing moments was when the person she did a joint venture with on a property declared himself bankrupt, leaving her unable to settle the property because she didn't have the funds.
So I actually invested some money with a colleague of mine, his brother, who was a developer. So I actually put quite a lot of money into that until this property on the harbour was ready. And the gentleman I invested the money with declared himself bankrupt. So left me in quite a, so I'm talking this would be 10 years ago, nearly 11 years ago. So it was like $280,000, which was my deposit for the property I was purchasing. And what happened was I didn't have the funds. I didn't have all the funds that I needed to settle on that property. So this is what can be scary, because I brought it off the plan, invested that money for that short amount of, well, you know, it's going to be 2 years till it was to be completed. So I thought I'll invest that money there because it's going to do this, this and this. And, of course, when I started asking for the money back, it wasn't coming back, and I then learnt what had really gone on. And that was naivety and my fault as well. You know, I've put my hand up and go, you know, I have to take 100% responsibility for that. However, that was very challenging times because that's when the GFC hit. And it wasn't my intention to hold the property. I was going to flip it. Couldn't sell it because lots of people put them on, you know, put their units back onto the market, and nobody could sell. So what I had to do then at that time was borrow a 97% low doc loan. Now, I was paying about 14% interest when interest rates at that time were about 6 or 7%.
This was a very hard period for Monkley, and she felt quite isolated and alone, afraid to tell people about her struggles for fear they would judge her for her mistake.
That was very, very challenging, I can tell you. I had many nights where, you know, I will say, well, I ate baked beans on toast. Someone said, we're having for dinner. I'd say, baked dinner, baked beans on toast. So that was, you know, I can tell you, I had nights where I would lie in bed and I'd be sweating, thinking, where am I getting the money from for the mortgage, you know? Particularly when you're on your own, that's, you know, that's a challenge too. You know, you've got no one that you can just even run your thoughts by around it. And I think too, pride can get in the way too. You think, God, who can I talk to them about this? And I don't want to, you know, oh, they'll think I'm an idiot for doing this. But I tell you what, I survived it. I at the time, I didn't ever think I would, but I did. And what I ended up doing was I sold half of it. So this was a good strategy and a good lesson for me, because I just happened to be talking to someone one day, and I said, and I did say, because I were a mortgage broker, and I said to them, look, gee, I don't know, you know, I think I'm going to have to sell this property or sell half of it. I just don't know, you know, what to do. And she said, oh, Claire, you know, we'd be interested in doing that. She said, we would love to get into property, and we've just not thought about how to go about it. She said, but be happy to come in with you. So I sold 50% of that property to her, and that, I can tell you, was an enormous thing, a relief off my mind worrying about this mortgage.
Luckily, she even managed to make some money from this property, and as a result of her learning experience, believes education is the key to success when it comes to property investing.
We went on to actually make a bit of money from that. Not a lot, because it was that whole 10 years for that GFC, you know, before things picked up again. But I did make a bit of money on it. But to me, that was my worst investment. But it was only because of circumstance, you know, me putting the money where it went and disappearing and the GFC hitting. So they're not things that you can predict, but it's trying to think of the way to come out of it. And this is the odd thing. I never asked any of my siblings if they wanted to come into that property. And I think it was because I was embarrassed, or I think they thought I was a failure. And, you know, to this day, a couple of them say, oh, you know, wished you had have asked us. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, Mom, I just, you know, I felt bad. I was just in a really bad spot and a very bad place mentally, I suppose. But I came through it and went on to be, you know, bigger and stronger. And I think that you know, it scared me, but now I'm like, oh, well, you know, it's all right. I suppose now I'm more educated, and that's the difference. I'm more educated, and I know, you know, there's more strategic planning that you can put around with where you purchase now. That's the difference. It's the education.
On the flip side, she shares with us one of her best investing moments, where Caveat on the property turned out to be a wonderful deal for her.
I purchased a block of land out at Mudgee, and somebody was going to buy it, and this is where people just maybe need to look a little bit deeper. Was going to purchase this block of land. There was a caveat in the contract that these particular people weren't comfortable with, but I sort of sent the contract off to my solicitor. She looked at it, you know, went through it, and she said, look, I don't think this will be an issue down the track, because the whole plan for that block of land was to actually subdivide it. But in the contract, it actually said something like, you know, the developer, you know, won't allow two dwellings on one block. But there was, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was only while they were developing. So once they were out of it, you know, my sister said, look, this is only why they hold it, but they're long gone, so I can't see an issue. And that's, these other people missed that opportunity, but I was able to get a great opportunity where I went on and built these two fabulous houses that, you know, I know Mudgee went back. Mudgee, again, it's probably 3 hours from Sydney, just to give you a bit of an idea. And so it is mining, but it does have other things. It's got agricultural, you know, horse studs, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country town. And so it did pull back. My plan was to sell one financial year and sell one the next. But again, it was the downturn in the coal mine industry. So I rented them, always been rented, positively geared. And now that was probably 5 years ago, but they're now sort of coming back because there's been a big announcement. So the values of the properties there have actually come back to a little bit more than what I was originally going to sell them 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm thinking maybe I might sell one of those this financial year. I'm just going to see how it goes, but maybe I will sell one of those. But that was a great aha moment for me, because I thought, you know, you've just got to look a little bit deeper into something before you actually say no to it. Because sometimes it's, you know, it can be our own misconception of what's, or the understanding of what's in a contract. And that's when you know, you have your team of experts around you that actually assist you with those things.
On this block of land that she bought, where the caveat in its contract put off other people, actually yielded a high return.
It was a large block of land. In a subdivision that had been going for quite a while. And I honestly think the reason why this particular block hadn't sold was because of this caveat that was in there, that a lot of people must have thought it was still valid, but it wasn't. As I explained, my sister said, no, it's only if the developers were still part of the development, but they were no longer part of it. She looked into that, and that's, you know, was the case. So I was able to put two homes, individual houses on it. So one was a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom, 1-car, and the second one was just 3-bedroom, 1-bathroom, 1-car. Beautiful little houses. I got a local builder who was highly recommended, and I have to tell you, he was amazing. When I went out and saw those houses for the first time, I said to him, my God, you have done an amazing job. And you know what his words to me were? I'll never forget them. He said, Claire, that's what you paid me to do. And I went, well, yeah, I did. But, you know, you don't always get that, you know. And it's like a 2.5-hour drive for me to get there. So it wasn't somewhere where I was going out and having a look at, but I did have a project manager that was keeping an eye on it. So that was a really good deal. And the granny flat one was as well. I have to tell you, that returns us some incredible money. So I bought that one with my daughter, and it was a great big corner block, and we just were able to come in. It had an easement, so we couldn't put a separate house on it, but we built a little granny flat, and the granny flat cost us about $128,000. And so now that property is giving us about a, 7.5% return because of the granny flat that's on it and where it's situated here, not far from Newcastle. So it's only probably 15 minutes from the CBD of Newcastle.
So, inspired by Claire Monkley's journey, we'll keep the conversation going in a future episode of Property Invest Story. We'll discuss the strategy.
So, one of the tools I have is a calculator that actually shows if you purchase one investment property and you can put in what your existing debt is, what your interest rate is, and if you purchase just one investment property, when the point of payoff can be.
How she matches clients to the right lenders.
The lender that I've now got him approved with, he fits in their age policy, he fits in their DSR, so their debt level, and he fits within their LVR, so their loan to value ratio.
What she would say to herself 10 years ago.
And I have to pinch myself because I go, how did this little country girl get to be sitting in this room with these people?
And that's next time in a future episode of Property Invest Story.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.